There are a lot of calls being made for a green revolution, but some say we can't become green without first becoming brown. They lead us to ask, which revolution should we start first, brown or green?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1204th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Lima who are tuned in as we on the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we begin with Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Seems kind of strange to say that, but gosh, if you think about it for just a moment, you realize that without agriculture, we'd all be hunting and gathering. And it wouldn't take too long before there wasn't much left to hunt and gather, given the fact that there's so many of us and we're so hungry. So, you know, it's when living so far removed from the source of our food as we do, it's easy to forget that elemental fact. We start thinking food comes from the grocery store, and it will always come from the grocery store. Then somewhere along the line, we wake up to the fact that we forgot about how important agriculture is to our day-to-day lives, and we become frightened by the fact that we have no control over our food or our environment. Perhaps that is one of the reasons why so many are now calling for a green revolution, to change the way we go about living here on planet Earth. Stop using plastic straws, they say, and eat bugs instead of beef. Recently, I ran across an article in The Conversation titled, Healthy Soil is the Real Key to Feeding the World, by David Montgomery, who is the author of Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. And you know, I thought that before we go out and start another revolution, we should pause to consider, which one should we start, the brown one or the green one? And who better to ask than the doctor of dirt, Professor David Montgomery? David, what do you think? Which one should we start first?
Well, hi, Michael. You know, I think brown is the new green.
There you go. Well, you know, there are some of us who actually think that, but there are some of us who are saying, what in the hell are you talking about? Brown is green.
Yeah, if you look at essentially the foundation for supporting a long-term agricultural society, healthy, fertile soil is really the foundation from which that wealth is drawn and how we can sustain large populations of people on the planet. So, and, you know, the thing we forgot about in the previous green revolution, the whole sort of the biotech revolution and the fertilizer-friendly crops that we went to in the late 20th century, is we kind of lost sight of what really is the foundation for good farming and healthy food, and that is healthy, fertile soil. Mm-hmm. And so what the brown revolution refers to, and that's a term that I first heard from Howard Buffett, actually, who's been advocating a brown revolution for as long as I've been advocating for a soil health revolution. The idea is that we need to reinvest in the health and fertility of the world's cropland, our farmland, our soils, as the foundation for building a greener revolution that could truly sustain farming for the long run and help feed the planet.
Do you think we can have a green revolution without having a brown revolution?
I don't think we can sustain intensive agricultural production over the long run without reinvesting in our soils. So I sort of see a brown revolution, a soil health revolution, as the foundation for building a lasting greener revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, you are a geomorphologist. What the heck is that, for those of us who don't know?
Yeah, a geomorphologist is the flavor of geologist that studies the here and now of what shapes landscapes. So it's it basically study landscape evolution, anything from what shapes mountain ranges from the Andes to the Himalaya to the Cascades near where I live in Seattle, right on down to things like what influences soil erosion on agricultural fields. Mm-hmm. How can we keep soil on our cropland where it does us good and keep it from washing down rivers? So it's the kind of geologist who deals with erosion and sedimentation, and that got me into looking at soils, which got me into looking at farming, and that led into the idea of, can you look at soil building processes on farms? What does it take to actually restore the soil as a consequence of intensive farming? And that's what I've been working on for the last couple books, and I've gotten very interested in it. So a geomorphologist deals with those kind of things, and I'm kind of a at the corner of where geomorphology meets sustainability.
And you've looked back in history to those civilizations that have done some pretty intensive farming and failed. What happened to them?
Well, about 10 years ago, I researched and wrote a book called Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, that looked at that very problem of how has farming practices affected the fertility of the world of agricultural lands in different regions of the world. And because if you think about the problem of maintaining farming, so the very first thing you need to do is keep the soil on the landscape, because plants grow in the soil. If you erode the soil off and you strip it down to bedrock, or you so degrade the soil that the fertility is squandered, it becomes very difficult to continue supporting agriculture in a piece of land or a region, or indeed you could even do that at planetary scale. And if you look at the history of different regions around the world, there's actually quite a profound history of regional landscape degradation that impacted the longevity of civilizations that you can basically place at the feet of agricultural practices, sustained over generations that gradually degraded the landscape to the point where it became harder to support a large population. And I got into looking at that as a series of regional studies back, looking at the history, and then started to worry about, we are kind of on track to be repeating this experiment at a global scale, and we don't really have any new regions to go to if we exhaust our agricultural soils at a planetary scale at this point. And I'm not arguing we're going to run out of dirt. There's lots of soil in the world, but the question is, how fertile will it be? And what's its ability to actually support large human populations? Will we outstrip that ability?
And given that notion, it would seem like we certainly must have a brown revolution before we can have a green revolution.
Yeah, we need a brown revolution if we're going to sustain and pull off a transition to a greener style of agriculture that can have a lower environmental footprint, manage to feed the world, and be sustained over the kind of time frames that a geologist like myself would consider actually sustainable. We've got to not only feed the world for the next few decades, we've got to do it for the next, for centuries, if not millennia.
So we have to really look way down in history and see the consequences of what we're doing today and how they will become manifest for our children's 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 children, or way down the line there.
Yeah, well, we can look back through history for insight into that, and we should be thinking forward, as you're suggesting, to try and avoid the worst consequences for subsequent generations. But this century, the 21st century, is where we really face a confluence of historical trends that mean that agriculture is going to need to change in a fairly profound way if we're going to make it through to that greener revolution built on top of the unfolding brown revolution.
Well, it seems like we city people have been running around quite a bit lately as if we were chickens with our heads cut off. And I remember that image from being on a farm myself. And it seems like we've kind of lost track of things, and we're, running around yelling in the dark about doing this and doing that, and, eating bugs instead of beef, and looking for some kind of ready-made salvation in a green revolution.
Yeah.
How did we become so lost?
Boy, that's a great question. And whether you look at sort of prescriptions for fixing agriculture, or just the question of what should we eat, what is the right diet for the future, arguments are all over the map. And the thing that I think that has really been we've taken our eye off of and lost is just how fundamental that relationship of agriculture to the soil is. It's so obvious in some ways that I think we take it for granted. But 97% of our food comes from the soil. About 3% of our food globally comes from the sea. So thinking about the nature of the soil as the foundation for agriculture is kind of what we lost sight of. We've been thinking about it as essentially something that plants will grow in, but to which we can add the fertilizers and the pesticides and the things that will help plants grow and produce a lot of crops in even degraded soil. But we've lost sight of what that actually does to the soil itself, its ability to sustain farming, what that means for the quality of our food. And that's where this idea of a brown revolution comes back in terms of reinvesting and rethinking about the nature of soil as the foundation for agriculture. And when we start doing that and starting to look at how could you build healthy, fertile soils as a consequence of agriculture, the answers you come up with are really different than the style of modern conventional agriculture that we've gravitated to as a species over the last 100 years.
We've come to see soil as kind of an inert medium upon which we could do our magic with our chemicals and our fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides and whatnot, but kind of discounted the notion of soil entirely, of living, breathing soil.
Yeah, we've lost sight of the biology in soil. And, you know, so we know that the chemistry of soil is important. We know that the physics of how water moves through soil, those things are very important for fertility and for agriculture. But what we lost sight of in the 20th century was the role of the biology, the sort of the living part of soil. And you can think of soil, there's lots of different ways to think about soil, but we've been thinking about it essentially as dirt, as essentially the inert part, as you were saying, and ignoring the role of life in the importance of cycling nutrients through soil, of unlocking mineral elements from the rock and soil particles and getting them into plants. The life in the soil, it turns out to be a pretty profound catalyst for nutrient transfers, for supporting the defense and health of crops, and even for the production of compounds in our food that in turn benefit us when we eat them and our microbiome uses them as fodder for their microbial activities in our gut to produce compounds that benefit our health. And a lot of that science in terms of microbial ecology in the soil and in our own bodies once food gets into us is actually pretty new in terms of the last few decades or so. So we're really at a point where we've got to, I think, re-engage with our philosophy of farming to bring back in the practices that cultivate the beneficial life that not only benefits our crops and their health, but that translates into health effects for us, too, in terms of our food being richer in compounds that have been shown to have preventative properties in terms of diet.
And it's all in the living. And that's what we like to put back into the soil via the brown revolution that we're talking about. Well, David, in your article in The Conversation, you bring up some food and agriculture myths that I think it would be a great way for us to get tuned back in to the notion of a brown revolution. So that's where we're going to go when we get back from this quick break here. Ladies and gentlemen, we have David Montgomery, who is a UW professor of geology and author of Growing a Revolution. And today we're talking about that brown revolution that he would like to start, which is a little bit different than the green revolution that others talk about. What we want to do is put life back into the soil, because what's in the soil then will find its way into us and we'll all be healthy and happy that way. We will be right back. Stay tuned. Well, there are a lot of myths that pop up in about food and about agriculture. Gosh, you can see that in a number of diets that we have and how we have real famous organizations like the American Heart Association telling us to eat one thing. And then we learn that maybe that's not the thing we want to be eating after all. So a lot of myths. And so we're going to take on some of the big myths of agriculture with David Montgomery today. And we'll start with the first big myth that always pops up in front of me, and that's large-scale agriculture feeds the world. Without large-scale agriculture, millions would starve. True or false, David?
Well, it's essentially, pose that simply, that would be false, which makes it a myth. There's you know, if we look at where most of the food is grown that feeds the world today, something like 3/4 of it is grown on family farms. And if we think of large-scale agriculture as being, you know, large-scale corporate industrialized farms, that's really not what's feeding the world today. 3/4 of the world's farms are smaller than 1 hectare, or about 2.5 acres. That's about the size of the block that I live on in urban Seattle. So if you look at where humanity's food is coming from, most of it's coming from smaller family farms around the world. Now, if you look in the developed world, of course, only about 1% of the population is engaged in farming today. And that's been a big transition historically. You go back 100 years ago in the United States, and it was something more like, you know, it was closer to between a third and a half. And you go back even farther, and it was even, you know, north of that. So when we think of, you know, where does conventional industrialized agriculture feed today, it's mostly the developed world where that holds true. And you know, almost the idea that we're feeding the world with U.S. agriculture is also essentially a sort of a sub-myth, if you will, of the large agriculture feeds the world today myth, where most of our agricultural exports from the U.S., I mean, something like 90% of them, are going to developed countries where you don't have a whole, where hunger is not a perennial problem. So the idea that our agricultural production is helping to feed the world is also sort of another myth. A lot of our agricultural produce goes to feeding automobiles with ethanol production, or to feeding livestock, which is then turned around and consumed here. So if we think about that question of does large-scale agriculture feed the world today, it's really not feeding the world today. You could make the argument that it's feeding much of the developed world today, and I wouldn't really argue terribly much with that one. But the idea that we, as a species, we're going to basically starve if we shift off of large-scale industrialized agriculture the way we consider conventional agriculture today, you know, for me, that rises to the category of myth. There's other ways to feed the world, and in fact, most of the world is fed in other ways today.
How did we come to think this, though? What was it that led us to believe that large-scale agriculture feeds the world?
Well, you know, large-scale agriculture has been very productive in increasing the production of some key commodity crops. And if you look at the, you know, what humanity tends to eat around the world, you know, the lion's share of our caloric input today is from, you know, corn, wheat, and rice, and the things that we make out of them. And large-scale industrialized agriculture has been very good at producing an awful lot of those three crops. Now, how much of that has done for human health and the quality of our diet is a whole other sort of subject. But we've essentially prioritized producing great quantities of very few things over producing a diversity of foods that would arguably be much healthier for us to base our diets on. And the style, if you want to actually produce a whole lot of just one or two crops, you know, large-scale industrialized agriculture is a way to do that. You know, I think we could even do that better if we reinvested in rebuilding the fertility of our soil. And I talk about that in the Growing Revolution book, sort of how the ideas that I have in that book that are rooted in the experience of farmers that I interviewed can show that we can rebuild healthy, fertile soils, even in an industrialized agricultural setting. But it's probably a lot more straightforward as to how to do that in smaller scale agriculture.
When I first came out with my book, Metro Farm, which of course is about farming small parcels of land close to the city, it was really kind of like people looked at me as if I was a heretic. You can't do that. You can't even talk about that. I was beginning to feel like, man, maybe I'm in a barked up the wrong tree here. But then I met a guy named Jacques Schmidt, who is with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Association organization. And he's the one that essentially wrote the book on urban agriculture, metropolitan agriculture. And he suggested, he was the first one to tell me that most of the food of the world comes from small parcels of land. And indeed, most of that is probably grown by women on small parcels of land close to the city. And that's the way most of the world gets its food. And I'm, after that, I wasn't feeling so so sad. Maybe I'm onto something here.
Yeah, you may just be ahead of the curve in trying to reintroduce that to the developed world.
I think I am, which that's what my wife says. You idiot, you're always 25 years ahead of where you should be. So maybe
And if you're far enough ahead of the curve, you'll be branded a heretic.
There it is. But then again, the world is changing significantly since that book came out and since you started doing your work as well. A lot of people are starting to listen now and wonder, about the ways of the soil and about, the impact of large-scale industrial agriculture. Is it what we need? And can we compete with it? So who knows? Maybe people are starting to listen.
I think they are. And I went through a lot of, a number of case studies in the book of farmers who'd made a more conservation agriculture style of agriculture really work for them on both small and large farms. And the I think that we're going to see a lot more growing interest in what could be done in urban environments, in the belts around urban environments, and we'll be starting to think more about, how do you build soil? How do you pull off this brown revolution, both in urban settings, in sort of regions right around urban settings, and then also in more rural areas where grain and dairy and meat production will probably remain concentrated because it's hard to do those things in a city. But we could be growing. We could be growing vast amounts of fruits and vegetables in urban environments and in areas around farms. And this past summer, my wife Anne Beclay, who wrote The Hidden Half of Nature with me, and I were visiting some small-scale or no-till vegetable operations around urban areas on the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S. that were incredibly profitable. These were thriving farms at that small-scale, diversified agriculture. And if you really wanted to look at how to grow the most food possible on the planet, small-scale diversified agriculture, the kind you've been talking about, is mm-hmm. the way to go.
And, ironically, I think one of the places where it probably still exists to a large extent, it would be Asia, which is, a lot of people on a small parcel of land. You have to figure out how to get maximum production out of minimum resources, which leads us to myth number two, which is large farms are more efficient than small farms.
Yeah, that's what another one of these really persistent myths in agriculture. And obviously I sort of picked these three to structure the article around because I thought they were important ones to discuss. And these are things you kind of often hear as soon as you engage in arguments about the future of agriculture. It's like, well, we've got to do big farms because they're more efficient. And if you look at sort of the growing of a single crop, there may be an argument to be had there.
For example.
Exactly. Whether you're growing corn or whether you're doing soybeans, if you have a monoculture, a big, large mechanized farm can really be a good way to produce a whole lot of that one particular crop. But if you actually go in and look at studies and you look at the data for, instead in terms of how many calories of food can you produce for human beings out of that piece of land, the tables totally flip, and it's small-scale, it's diversified agriculture, and particularly small farms that have the highest output of food per hectare. And in part because they're not just growing one crop, they're growing a diversity of things. So there's been farms that I've been in Africa, some of the people I talked about in Growing a Revolution, who were growing 6 to 8 crops in the same field at the same time.
Right.
So if you think about growing food as an exercise in capturing solar energy, because that's sort of the ultimate sort of source of the energy that's driving the photosynthesis that builds the carbohydrate backbones of plants that then feed herbivores and ultimately all the way up to carnivores. If you think of it just in terms of the efficiency of capturing that solar energy, if you've got plants at different levels in the canopy, an understory, a middle story, and a canopy, you're going to be capturing more of that and conceivably turning more of that into food. If you have plants that are co-planted so that you have multiple plants on the same piece of land producing food at the same time, you integrate that all up and you can grow more food per hectare. You could better feed the world on small-scale diversified farms. What you're not going to be able to do is to be able to produce, as high a volume of commodity crops of the corn and the soy and the wheat that we have dedicated modern conventional farming to overproducing.
Well, this discussion has raised two very interesting points to me that I did not see in your article. One of them is the intelligence it takes to grow the two kinds of crops, you know, the where you have one where you're growing six crops at the same time. Wow,
yeah.
that's a lot of variables that you have to contend with.
Yes, and I think that's one of the big ways we went wrong in the 20th century with agriculture is that we did two things. We basically assumed that we could make, you know, sort of all soils across the landscape respond to the same standardized set of practices, you know, intensive tillage, intensive nitrogen use, and followed by intensive pesticide use. We basically tried to get the landscape to behave as if there's one kind of soil, we'll do everything everywhere because that's the equipment that we have and the style that we have. So we lost sight of the diversity of the land itself. And we also didn't really, we've kind of failed to engage fully the creativity and intelligence of the world's farmers. These are engaged people who understand their land better than others generally, and I think that this style of farming that relies less on a few simple practices and inputs and more on understanding, if you will, the agroecology of their piece of land to grow multiple crops, whether in a crop rotation or in a field all at once, like some of the African farmers I was visiting were doing. You know, that takes thought and knowledge and understanding and intentionality in the way that one designs and varies one's crop rotation. Engaging the ingenuity of the world's farmers is something that I think a brown revolution would really, really benefit
right,
from.
Right. And those farmers aren't using the same kind of inputs that the large industrial farmers are using either, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can do that on a small farm, but you don't have to. And you actually don't have to on the large industrialized farm either. I mean, one of the things that I found in interviewing farmers around the world is that if you look at farmers who have been very successful at rebuilding the fertility of their land, you know, upping the carbon content of their soil organic matter content, increasing their microbial life, the bacteria and fungi in the soil, really bringing literally their soil back to life, they are able to grow comparable crops as their conventional neighbors, but using less fertilizer, less diesel, less pesticide. That makes them more efficient because they're growing the same amount of calories with fewer inputs. And you can do that at large scale. You can also do it at small scale. But the key thing is really a change in thinking about the nature of the soil, what you're trying to do with the soil. If you adopt practices that cultivate the beneficial life in the soil, then it can help offset the need for some of those chemical amendments, the fertilizers and the pesticides. And the first step in cultivating beneficial life in the soil is stop tilling. Don't plow so much.
Right.
Because it's imagine what would happen if somebody came by your house every year, pulled the roof off in January, stirred up all your possessions with a great big spoon, and then walked away. You wouldn't be living there very long. It'd be a horribly disturbing environment to be in. That's what a plow does to soil life. And so we have these different angles on sort of what makes large farms, how to look at the myth that large farms are more efficient, whether from the production of calories or from the use of inputs in producing those calories. Small-scale diversified farms, and particularly farms that adopt conservation agriculture principles that could allow them to reduce fertilizer, diesel, and pesticide use, those start looking better and more efficient, but doesn't mean we have to do it on large-scale conventional farms.
Well, and then the one thing that we really haven't been talking about then, haven't run across yet, is the difference in the food, the quality of the food being presented by both of these models here. Where you have large scale, you can benefit by the economies of scale involved in equipment purchases and chemical purchases and whatnot. And so you can really benefit, but you can pretty much, you're stuck with one kind of crop and one kind of, essentially, one kind of technology. Whereas working with a small parcel of land, you have six different kinds of crops going. I'm thinking about the quality of the food involved here. There must be a significant difference in the kinds of food we eat.
Well, you know, you've just hit on the topic of the book that Ann and I are working on now. We owe it to our publisher this spring. It'll be titled "You Are What Your Food Ate," but it focuses on
"You Are What Your Food Ate."
You are what your food ate. Yeah, we all know the "you are what you eat" statement, but we're basically trying to push it back one step further and look at, you know, how much of a difference does it matter to the quality of food and therefore human health as to how we farm, how we grow our crops, how we raise our livestock, how we do our dairy. And if you start looking at, you know, we all know that, you know, you can walk into any bookstore in the United States and go to the health and diet section, and there'll be all kinds of people telling you about what you should and shouldn't eat. And it's almost all focused on what to eat. And what we're trying to look at is, okay, well, you know, we know that that matters, and people have their own opinions about what's best and so forth, and there's medical and data we can bring to bear on some of those issues. But the question of, you know, how much does it matter how that food was grown, is the question that we're really focused on. Because if you look at...
And that's what we're going to pick up when we come back. Because that leads us to the third myth that we want to discuss. And that's the conventional farming. It's really necessary to save the world. We have to farm this way. But do we? Maybe not. If we have a brown revolution. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with David Montgomery, UW professor of geology and author of Growing a Revolution. Right back. Well, there is a difference in food. You know, an apple is just an apple, perhaps, if it came from the same tree. But if there's a lot of different ways of growing an apple, and that makes a big difference in what's inside the apple. And that's where David Montgomery's going. And you are what your food eats. Amazing concept. Love it. And I think it's a way of thinking about our future. So myth number three, conventional farming is necessary to feed the world. Why do we think that?
Well, you know, the root of that, and that's literally one of the first things that you hear when you talk with most people in the media about the future of farming and the idea that, oh, if we go organic, we'll all starve because we won't be able to grow enough food. You know, the argument for that is rooted in what are known as meta-analyses or meta-studies, you know, studies of studies. So if you want to address the question, say, of how much do organic methods produce as much food as conventional methods? You know, if you were running a graduate seminar somewhere and wanted to address that question, you'd send your students off to gather as many research papers as you could find that had addressed that question and then tally them all up and go, okay, well, what do most of those studies find? And so those kind of studies of studies are called meta studies. And most of the meta studies that have been done on that question of what are the yields of organic and conventional crops, which one is larger? They usually find that organic production results in about a 10 to 20% lower harvest than conventionally grown crops. And so that's the sort of statistic that you tend to hear trumpeted in reports about this, because that, you know, that sounds pretty serious. Grow 10 to 20% less food, yeah, that means maybe 10 to 20% less people could be fed. It's easy to connect those dots. But the problem is that meta-studies don't always sort of tell the full story, because what actually was in the studies that they have compiled can be fairly different. So there's the danger of having an apple, oranges, and kumquats comparison, where, you know, these things are not all sort of equal studies. So there was a, you know, if you look into the most recent of those, or the recent one in 2015, I think I looked into for the article that we're talking about today, there was another meta-study that sort of went a step further and looked at comparing crop yields on conventional organic farms where there were cover crops and the organic farms were rotating crops and using cover crops to build soil health. And the yield gap shrank to under 10%. And the authors of that study argued that there was even evidence of the meta-studies had skewed data to studies that report higher conventional yields, in part because, say, you're going to study this question, and you took a field that had been under conventional management for, let's just say, 50 years, and you planted a cultivar, a crop variety that was, that was bred for success in a conventional environment. It needs a lot of fertilizer, for example. And then you took that same cultivar and you grew it in with organic methods and conventional methods in that thoroughly degraded soil. It'd be no surprise that you'd find the conventional outproduce the organic because the cultivar was adapted to conventional methods, the soil was already degraded, and so you're basically the organic practices would be working from behind the ball to begin with. If you start controlling for those kind of influences in these meta-studies, most of the yield gap starts to disappear. So if you look at studies that just compared growing crops in healthy, fertile soil, really high-quality, life-filled soil versus conventional methods, there's usually not much of a difference in yield. So the one element of this myth of conventional farming is necessary to feed the world is rooted in the style of studies people have done to address the question. The real question, in my mind, ought to be if you went to organic producers who had really high-quality soil, high-quality practices, can they compete on yield, a yield basis with conventional farms that are using a lot of chemicals on degraded land like most of the farmland in the developing world? And the answer to that one is, yeah, they can compete on the basis of yields. And I can say that with some confidence because those are some of the farmers that I visited in Growing a Revolution, who some of them I started calling organic-ish farmers because they were not fully organic farmers, but they had adopted soil health building practices, and they had rebuilt their health of their soil enough that they basically didn't need much in the way of fertilizers, hardly any pesticides.
Right. Some time ago, I was given a visit to a demonstration of an organic plot of soil. It was a conventional farmer, a berry farmer, who was experimenting with organic technologies, and essentially what he did is he just took a plot of his conventional farmland and then did nothing to it.
And called that
organic because he didn't use any fertilizers or pesticides. And, you know, this is a very smart man, too. But but it looked kind of silly, you know. So what about this notion of bias in studies?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you see bias like that in some of those meta-studies where, I mean, the power of a meta-study is you're getting lots of studies, so you get statistical power just in terms of number of studies. But if the studies that are drawn into those meta-studies have serious differences, like that example that you just showed, or you were just talking about with a farmer who basically did nothing on the organic plot. Technically, that was an organic plot because he wasn't adding chemicals or prohibited substances. But it's no surprise that, you know, if there's no manure, if there's no return of nutrients to the soil, there's no cover crops for green manure, then, yeah, that organic plot is going to perform worse than his fertilized neighboring conventional plot. You haven't learned anything by doing that, to be frank.
There you go.
And meta-studies don't control for those kind of differences, or they generally don't. You can actually get into them and parse them and try and look at them, which I did, I forget what chapter in Growing a Revolution was, but trying to look at that kind of stuff. And when you look at the studies where the organic practices are done in really healthy, rich, fertile soil, the yield gap virtually goes away. And it's well below, we waste something like a third of the food that's produced at present in the developed world. And, you know, even if you took the meta-studies that argue for a 20% yield penalty for organic, even if you took that at face value, that's still smaller than the amount of food we actually throw away.
There you go.
So, you know, there's another way to solve the problem of feeding in the world, and that's, don't waste so much food. But the real question in my mind is about the long term. Because if we basically degrade the fertility of our land to the point where we need fertilizers and pesticides, what happens if those become so expensive that they're not really all that useful
economically? Well, that leads us to another myth that you brought up. You didn't really put this myth on the table as a myth, but you did. And it was organic farming is sustainable farming.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically, I think that was the lead sort of thing with the article, because you want to have a little twist that gets you go like, what? Mm-hmm. But if you look back at the history of farming, which the Dirt Book, the Erosion of Civilizations book did, you know, the kinds of farming practices that helped undermine the Roman Empire were organic, because they didn't have agrochemicals in those days. And so what was the problem? They plowed too much. And so I've been on a number of modern organic farms that have just beat their soil up with excessive tillage. And the reason, of course, they do that is that plowing is really good weed control, right? If you're right. worried about, you know, weed problems on your farm, you know, plowing the weeds up is a pretty good way to get rid of them. But if you look at over the long run, it can lead to erosion of the soil. It can lead to degradation of the organic matter in the soil. And so one of the comparisons Ann and I were doing this summer with some farms is comparing some really productive vegetable farms that had very minimal disturbance practices. They did minimal disturbance, they did cover crops, had a great diversity of their crops, and then comparing them to high disturbance organic farms in the same valley that, you know, were organic, they had good practices in terms of pesticide and fertilizer use, but they just, you know, they tilled the snot out of their soil. Mm-hmm. And there was a real difference in the soil quality. And so we're running some experiments to look at whether those differences translate into food quality. And, you know, hopefully by the time the You Are What Your Food Ate book comes out, we'll have some answers.
Good. Look forward to answers. So organic has, you know, been around for a while now. It's big business. But as it is around and becomes subject of big business, there are those who want to play as well. And they tend to go to, you know, where the power is located in Washington, D.C., and petition the National Organic Standards Board to change the standards so that they can fit in too.
Yeah.
And so, as we've seen over the course of years, what was organic was started about that life in the soil that you speak of, but not so much anymore. In fact, you can grow organic food in water that has no life in it at all. Where is that taking us?
Yeah, that represents a real sea change in just what the organic label represents. So if you buy something at the grocery store with the organic label, I mean, most people would think about it as something that was grown in soil that was, you know, treated well. You'd like to think it was healthy, fertile soil. You can be confident that organic foods will have less pesticides. Every comparison that's been done to that finds that, and for good reason, because they don't tend to use pesticides. But the idea that you would be able to grow food organically without it ever having seen the soil is something that I think when the people were originally framing the USDA organic standards, they never could have imagined that an organic farmer would want to grow something without it ever seeing the soil. And so the move, what was it, last year I guess it was, for the Organic Standards Board to allow hydroponic practices, growing food in water or in a nutrient solution, to be certified as organic, really represents a step away from what I think the original vision of organic agriculture was. And there's real questions about what that will do to the food that's grown in it. Now, you could always add mineral elements in the soluble form for the plants to slurp up, like within their using the roots like straws out of a solution. But how many growers will actually add that full complement of nutrients?
How does a farmer know what the plant requires? I mean, how can you possibly know? And the thing about living soil is that it just, you know, puts out a smorgasbord of nutrients, and a plant can decide for itself.
Well, the plants will actually tailor their own exudates, the sugars and the proteins and the fats and the carb that they will push out, they will exude out of their roots into the soil to feed particular kinds of soil life that will then help go get the very mineral elements that those plants need and want. So it's the plants are essentially active participants in recruiting assistance from soil life that gives the plants what they need. The plants know what they want, and they're basically go out and look for it, and they develop partnerships with organisms in the soil. And all that mediation, the back and forth, the chemical signaling, the stimulation to make phytochemicals, things like sulforaphane in broccoli, for example, that which has, you know, has demonstrated anti-cancer properties. You know, if you're eating broccoli for the concerns about cancer prevention, you want it to have a lot of sulforaphane in it.
Yeah.
That tends to happen in response to engagement with soil life. So how will that work in a hydroponic system? There's big questions around it. I think there's more questions than there are answers. But
well,
the simple fact in my mind is that, you know, nobody, when they proposed the organic standards, would have thought that somebody would down the road propose that you could grow organic food without it ever seeing the soil.
And yet, when you adopt these controlled environment production technologies, using growing plants in water in a warehouse somewhere, you really become God, the God. You must, you know, you must decide and determine what the plant needs when it needs it, because there's no other place for it to get it except you. And you have to provide it.
And so the question is, are you going to be Yahweh or are you going to be Loki?
There you go. whereas, you know, we talk about the intelligence of the grower and what it takes to be a real smart grower. When you have a brown revolution farmer who's building life into the soil and does that, you know, then the soil takes care of everything. But when you take total charge of everything, when you become the responsible one, you have to provide everything. And where are you going to get the knowledge to do that? Does anybody have that knowledge?
No. I mean, you're right. You're right on exactly the right point. It's like what we've been learning about the sort of the relationships between plants and soil life over the last few decades is that it's incredibly complicated. It's far more complicated than I was taught in grad school a couple decades ago. And we're just starting to uncover, I think, the depth and breadth of all the relationships between plants and soil life and how they may impact then the quality of the food that's actually produced, its mineral content, its phytochemical content.
And it's all going to be in your next book?
Well, we're going to have a down payment on it in the next book.
Okay. Well, I look forward to bringing the both of you on again to talk about you are what your food ate. This has been the Food Chain Radio program with Michael Olson. Today we had a great conversation with David Montgomery and you. So I want to thank you all for tuning in. And to remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you, David.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson.